Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We will be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is yet again, Mark Germain. For those of you that listen to the podcast, Mark will be a familiar name. He is a performance nutritionist and alumni of the prestigious Liverpool John Moores University and works with many high-level boxers across the UK. Mark was the first guest we ever had on the podcast, and he gave us a comprehensive overview of how to structure nutrition in a fight camp. We also discussed his current thinking about the strategies we use to make weight from a physiological standpoint. As is the nature of science, it is constantly evolving and changing, and because of that, so has Mark's opinion on a number of issues. I've gotten Mark back onto the podcast to discuss how his thoughts and practice has changed over the last 12 months based on these changes we have seen in the scientific literature. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Very special episode today because we've got the guy that godfathered in the Fight Science Podcast, very first episode. We got Mr. Mark Germain rejoining us to come back. Mark, thanks for coming on, mate.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to come back on, Jordy. Thanks very much for the offer.
Mate, so I think we'll chat in a little bit offline there. There's plenty that we want to go through. I think it would be really cool because this whole podcast series, we've had so many great guests and we've talked about so much great science going through. I think what would be really cool today is to kind of go through that on a deeper level, and both yourself and I do this in practice and kind of talk about the things, even though we've got this science, what are some questions that we're still left with there? But before we get into all of that, you are now on the board with the ACSM, the American College of Sports Medicine Combat Sports Special Interest Group. Can you give us a little backstory? How did that come to be? And how did your annual conference go a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, so I suppose probably, I think it was over a year ago now, that Reid was looking, Reid Real is the chair of the group. You know, we've had a Reid on before and people probably know who Reid Real is. And if they don't, he's currently the performance nutrition manager at UFCPI Shanghai. So he was essentially looking to bring on a member for the team because they were thinking about creating a newsletter that can go out around the year. And I remember I was chatting to Carl Lang and Evans at the time, and I said it to him, and he was like, you know, just try your name in the hat. So I got in contact with Reid. Reid seemed keen and took me on board. And then from there, I kind of just got bumped up to a co-chair for the group. So that's how I got onto the board for the ACSM Combat Sport. And then with the conference, so just in case people aren't aware, usually ACSM do an annual general meeting every year around kind of May, June. So this year it was meant to be from May 26th to the 30th in San Francisco. But obviously because we've had this coronavirus pandemic across the world, most scientific conferences have been cancelled. So our normally at these, we have like a breakaway session, which lasts probably about an hour. So we thought, you know, it was pretty easy just to put that online. And the goal was like, we just asked people, we didn't know how big it would be, but we said, you know, we'll just put it out that if people are interested, we might do it online, and then we'll give people an opportunity to, you know, if they've been doing any research and they want to share, like not everyone is going to have the opportunity to travel to ACSM. So that's why, and it actually turned out to be pretty more successful than I thought it was going to be. Like we only thought like maybe 50 people and, you know, less than a handful of presenters, you know, who might have volunteered to present. But we had a good lineup of speakers. I know a lot of them have been coming onto the podcast as well. So that was quite successful. So much so that we ended up having to run the conference over 2 days or 2 weeks instead of just doing it on a single day. And the recordings are actually, well, most of the recordings are up on Dropbox as well. So if people do want to go back and watch any of the presentations, I'll be able to give them the Dropbox link and they'll hop on there, download the presentations and watch them on the laptop.
Yeah, and I could not recommend that highly enough. Like Mark said, a lot of the guests have been coming on and they presented it in such a great way. And Mark, can you just let them know if people are listening and they want to get in and they want to look at the presentations from that, what's the best email that they can get you at to get that link?
Probably markgermain91@gmail.com, because my university emails tend to change all the time. So that's the one that just stays constant.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Mark, well, let's get into it. So
When you came on the first time, we had this huge overview, pretty much set the precedence for the entire podcast. We went through fight camp nutrition, we went through fight week nutrition, post weigh-in period, what you do when you get out of it. Since then, that was probably, I don't know, like over a year ago, probably a bit more now. The way that science goes is that the literature, the studies, the evidence is always changing. Let's go through a few topics and let's talk about a few things in terms of more the practical side and some things that, even though we have all this information about how you go about treating combat sports nutrition, when it comes to putting this in place, let's have a chat about, you know, what are some things you need to consider when it comes to doing this in place. And I think a good topic to always start with this is this topic of glycogen, and even knowing how much glycogen we have, how you measure it, and then glycogen's role, and then how diet plays in. So I'm going to leave the floor to you. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts when it comes to glycogen? Where are we at with it?
Yeah, so I guess even from as little as a year ago when I was last on, I probably have two changes in perception when we're thinking about glycogen and carbohydrate. So just roll back, just in case any listeners are listening and they don't understand what we're talking about. So glycogen is basically just a stored form of carbohydrate. You store, depending on how well trained you are, anywhere between 400 to 800 grams in the muscle, and then another 80 to 120 grams in the liver. But, you know, when it comes to weight cutting, that's weight that we can cut out of the system pretty easy. And then every gram of glycogen has about 3 grams of water associated with it as well. So you're thinking nearly, if you have nearly a kilo of glycogen in the body and then another 3 kilos then of water associated with that, you're, you know, that's a big chunk of your weight cut when you're thinking of fight week, if you can get it down effectively. So like, I suppose I'll just roll back. So what I said, I think last time about a year ago, I said, no, you know, you don't want to be low carb all the time or for too long because it downregulates like PDH activity. And again, people aren't 100% sure on PDH. It basically, if I describe it, it's kind of like an entry gate for carbohydrate metabolism to get into aerobic metabolism. So, you know, just for people listening, you have anaerobic and aerobic. So aerobic takes place in like the mitochondria. You know, you're thinking about quote unquote fitness as opposed to power, speed. And so basically it's a regulatory point in that. And my kind of point at the time was, if you turn that down, then you're potentially turning down the aerobic ability to use carbohydrate. But at the moment, I'm writing a review with, so Brendan Egan and Mark Evans is leading it, from a glycogen point of view. But the idea is around glycogen sparing, because there's been ketone research which has come out from, I think, Peter Hespel's lab. And, you know, there's been this idea in, you know, ketogenic studies for a while. You know, people who are looking at studying ketogenic diets and they're, you know, looking at the idea of sparing glycogen and then automatically assuming that sparing glycogen equals increased performance, because, you know, you're saving the glycogen for another time. And then you have this idea of glycogen sparing versus impairing, because it doesn't actually say, you know, people are saying, well, it's not sparing glycogen, you're impairing the ability to use glycogen. So I've kind of been going through a lot of this research, and there's been at times as well, I've been drawing parallels to combat sports. So like, I have some comments down, like how is this to apply to combat sports in my notes as well. But I suppose from one thing is, if you look at PDH, and 2 points as it relates to combat sport, and it's one is that I remember at the time I was saying like low carb, like a long time, the trademark or the classical paper which is often referenced with regards to PDH is Trent Stellingworth's paper in 2002. And, you know, the low carb condition in that condition was actually 2.5 grams per kg carbohydrate. Now, if you think about how much carbohydrate you feed a fighter during camp, you know, the recommendations in Carl's paper in 2011 is 3 grams per kg. It's basically the same. So you basically are down-regulating PDH, well, quote-unquote, down-regulating PDH for the whole camp based on what's classified as low in Trent Stellingworth's paper. So one, even though I was saying you don't want to go completely low carb all the time, but if you're going off the research in Stellingworth's paper, it's down-regulated pretty much throughout the whole camp, unless you can do some sort of cyclical carbohydrate feeding strategy. You know, if you're going some sort of like hybrid approach, like Jackson might have talked about, where you're doing, you know, higher carb days in the middle of the week, you know, before sparring or something like that. Maybe that's another way that you can do it, so that it's not just chronic low carbohydrate. because at 2.5 to 3 grams, it probably is classed as a low carbohydrate diet. So that's one thing where, you know, I'm just kind of trying to look at the research and say, and think of how I'm applying it to combat sport, is that, you know, I was saying last time, you don't want to be too low, but to be honest, we are low throughout the camp. And then another point as well is that I'm kind of rethinking the way we see this activation of PDH in general, because in that Stellingworth paper, I think I was saying before, that they had, or so they had a 20-minute steady state period. Then they had 1 minute at 150% peak power output. They took a muscle biopsy before steady state and then after the peak power output as well. And then they did a time trial after that. Now, they didn't take a biopsy after the time trial, which is kind of annoying, but, you know, you can understand why taking all the biopsy. That's actually a common feature in a lot of research, is that if they do these type of trials where they do like fat adaptation, they'll do a biopsy before the steady state, after the steady state, but they which is before the time trial, but you never see a biopsy after the time trial. But anyway, it just makes it very hard to draw a concrete conclusion on what I'm going to say. But what essentially happens is after the peak power output in the classic study from Stellingworth, which is saying like downregulation of PDH is like leading to impaired carbohydrate utilization. So they did have a decrease in maximal PDH activity after the 150-minute peak power output and after the steady state, 20-minute steady state as well. However, if you look at the glycogen use, they measured obviously glycogen pre and post. There was no difference in pre-exercise muscle glycogen I should preface this just so people know. They did like 5 days of like low carb and then carbohydrate loaded on the sixth day, so that, you know, you're having this kind of train low, compete high effect. Yeah, so there was no difference in pre-exercise muscle glycogen, which is, I think, is important. There was actually no difference in muscle glycogen after the 150% peak power output. So it didn't impair the ability to use glycogen. But they kind of said that there was evidence for decreased glycogenolysis, because I think there was increased like glucose 6-phosphate, for example. But actual measured muscle glycogen was no difference between conditions. And then importantly for me is that there was no difference in time trial performance. You know, so they went and performed the exact same during the time trial. And that's repeatable across the literature as well. So if you look at Louise Burke's earlier studies, I think there's 2000, 2001, 2002, where they applied this model where they do 5 days low carb, carbohydrate refeed in the sixth day, and then compete on the seventh day. None of those papers show impaired performance compared to just staying high carb all the time. So I think I've fallen foul of this myself in the past. I've automatically thinking, oh, when you're going low carb all the time, you're downregulating PDH and you're automatically impairing performance. And it doesn't seem to be the case. I'm struggling to find any good research to say that that's the case, that it does impair performance. Like, there's another one as well in 2006. It's like Haveman. 2006, and that's often used. And they did a 100-kilometer time trial performance, and they did some 1 kilometer sprints and 4 kilometer sprints, and power output was decreased in the 1 kilometer sprints in the group who had been like low train low compete high, but there was no difference in the 4 kilometer sprints, and there was no difference in 100 kilometer time trial performance. So I don't think it's too strong of evidence to say it. So I'm kind of rethinking how I view the whole kind of fat adaptation paradigm, because what does happen is that the ability to use fat as a fuel is still present after you refeed glycogen. So you're still able to oxidize fat more effectively. And I think that's what's going on with PDH, to be honest, because what I think I was saying offline before is that what happens in these studies with PDH is that you've got a lower baseline activity of PDH, but the relative increase as exercise intensity goes up is pretty similar, but the gap doesn't close. And if you look back in some of the earlier studies, I think like in the late 1990s, you can see that the periods of high fat feeding, so if you do like 5 days, it's reminding me now the author of this, he's done a few papers back in the early 2000s, it's like Berg or something like that. But anyway, if you feed high fat diet or low carb diet for, you know, 5-6 days, what you do is you get a doubling of intramuscular triglyceride content, because, and I think that's what's fueling this is just like my opinion now because no one's actually like measured it, but I think that's what's primarily causing the difference in PDH. I think you've got increased intramuscular triglyceride content. So you've got less of a need to use the carbohydrate because you're fueling more. Because as well, even though fat oxidation is higher, like these studies are feeding carbohydrate during exercise, plasma fatty acids stay the same. So there's no real difference in like adipose tissue like lipolysis. So I think it's primarily driven between, you know, these periods of going low carb or high fat, they increase intramuscular triglyceride content. And then Stellingworth also had a paper that showed like one of the adaptations to training is that you actually increase the amount of intramuscular triglycerides that you use during exercise. So I think that's what's kind of fueling the difference in PDH. And I'm not really convinced that it's having an effect on exercise performance because the research just doesn't support it at the moment. And I've been going through trying to fight it, but I basically just, you know, on the more I've read, the more I realized that was wrong last year when I was saying about, you know, PDH this and thinking that PDH was so crucial. Now, what I actually think happens, well, see, it's hard. I think with PDH, if you look at some of the mechanistic research as well, that also wouldn't support that PDH is the regulatory point directly. Because if you look at stuff where they've infused lipids during exercise, so they use like put like either saline or lipid infusion. And what happens there is you'll get increased obviously oxidation of lipids because you're infusing it. And how that regulates carbohydrate metabolism more so than PDH is that you get less of an increase in AMP and ADP because, you know, you're matching the ATP turnover from fat, and then that less of a decrease in ADP and AMP reduces the activity of glycogen phosphorylase. So then you don't need as much glycogen because you're at the moment you're fueling it all from fat. So then you've got less glycogen being pushed through, you know, the glycolytic pathway. So obviously then you get less PDH through there. So that would be the mechanistic reason for why you get less PDH as opposed to direct regulation. Again, just in case people are interested. So if you look at PDK, so I think I said it last time as well, just so people are aware. So PDH is highly regulated, but so it can be active in a dephosphorylated state. So if you think about an enzyme, it's like with phosphorylation, it can be like an on or off switch. So if you add a phosphate group to PDH, it kind of turns it inactive. And if you take it away, it kind of becomes active. And how that is kind of regulated with PDH is that you've got like enzymes called PDK. So it's a kinase. So that adds a phosphate to it and turns it away, or adds a phosphate to it and turns it off, basically. But if you look at any of Sandra Peters' research, so she was with Lawrence Spreet. She has her own lab now, I think. But PDK, so in response to diet, it's very, very responsive. So that will rock bottom. You go low carb, PDK will shoot up, and that will regulate PDH activity. But within a couple of hours of feeding carbohydrate, you can restore PDK back to normal. So PDK is no longer regulating PDH activity. So the activity of PDK, once you start putting carbohydrate back in the system, that doesn't seem to be any longer affecting PDH activity, which again would kind of like feed into my thought that it's not so much that PDH, we're getting this massive down regulation of PDH as a response to diet, you know, particularly once you put carbohydrate back in, as opposed to I think that we've upregulated our ability to use fat. And you're getting increased in intramuscular triglyceride storage and oxidation, and then that's just reducing the amount of carbohydrate that we're needing for that given activity, for example. Now, the flip side of that is that there's also no evidence that increases performance. So it's not like you have to do this, but it's just that, you know, it's not really as detrimental to performance as maybe I might have suggested last time. It doesn't really seem to be much that it is detrimental to performance. And the caveat, it's a big caveat, but it's like considering you have to have start the muscle glycogen has to be the same. So what seems to be the most important is that muscle glycogen at the start of exercise is the same. So once you, and we do that in combat sport anyway, you know, after the weight cut, you're loading them with carbohydrate anyway. So I suppose that would be that kind of glycogen, something that I've changed my thoughts on. I've got another one as well that I've been kind of reading, because after going through this research as well, I'm kind of rethinking the way that we cook carbohydrate as well, because, you know, I know like some people go, like I've typically done about 5 days out is when I start to cook carbohydrate previously. I know some others do 7, so I know some do 10. And I'm starting to think even 5 days is too much now, because going low carbohydrate or like cutting it food out of the diet is actually not a very effective way to cut muscle glycogen. It will cut liver glycogen. Liver glycogen responds very well to diet manipulation, but muscle glycogen doesn't. Like, you will reduce it a little bit, but if you want to effectively reduce muscle glycogen, exercise is the best way. And I'm starting to think now that, you know, we might, now this could be very individual now as well, for your athletes. So some people might prefer different ways. You know, you get some athletes who just prefer shorter, harder cut. You know, they don't want to do it long, slow throughout a week. They just want to, you know, last 36, 40 hours. That's what they want to do. They're prepared just to bite down a little bit more for it. So it could be individual as well. But I think if you want to actually more effectively, and this is like well enough documented through the literature that, if I could show a graph, I would. But actually, I'll show up a graph on Instagram later on. But so, for example, there was this study which looked at the effects of 3 days of fasting, so no food at all, so like obviously no carbohydrate, versus, you know, just 3 days of feeding. And they came into the lab after an overnight fast. So one group had eaten up to the night before, the other group had fasted for 3 days straight. And there was no significant difference in starting muscle glycogen concentration. So there was no, you know, despite one group having eaten for 3 days and the other group not, in terms of muscle glycogen, there was a slight decrease in the fasted group, you know, but what wasn't like quote unquote statistically significant, and it wasn't clinically significant either. It wasn't significant to the point that if you're doing a diet to cut glycogen, it was cutting glycogen, if that makes sense. You know, probably a part of that was that there was no exercise in them 3 days. So maybe if you were doing exercise in them 3 days, it probably would have been, but anyway. But you're probably, if you eat food, you're going to go back up in it anyway. Yeah, so there was no difference in that. And what also happens, like, again, it kind of ties into this other point that I was saying around, you know, increased fat oxidation and stuff like that. If you haven't fed carbohydrate, you decrease glycogen use. So, you know, the longer you're low carb, the less glycogen you use because you're using more fat. So, like, again, in this study, I think the group who had fasted for 3 days actually finished with the exact same exercise protocol. They actually finished with slightly higher muscle glycogen than the other group, because you decrease, your ability to use carbohydrate, but you get quote unquote glycogen sparing if you don't put carbohydrate in. Now, I don't know if he said it on your podcast, but Lewis James said something interesting during his talk for ACSM, which I actually agree with. And he was saying, like, later on in the week, he'll give them like a bag of Haribo or something like that in the last couple of days instead of totally cutting out. And for me, that makes sense, because the best way to kind of like make sure that you're using glycogen is put carbohydrate into the system. And if you look at any of the like carbohydrate oxidation or carbohydrate feeding during exercise, you know, again, it's a little bit of a myth that spares muscle glycogen. You know, you don't really spare muscle glycogen doing carbohydrate. If you look through all the carbohydrate feeding research, you don't spare muscle glycogen when you feed carbohydrate during exercise. You might spare liver glycogen because you're maintaining blood glucose levels, but if you don't feed carbohydrate, that's what's going to, you know, reduce the amount of muscle glycogen you're using. You know, like over time in classical studies where like muscle glycogen decreases as extra. You know, if you keep carbohydrate in the system, you're keeping the body switched on to use carbohydrate. So I think that was a pretty interesting point and something that I agree with that Lewis did bring up, that he'll give like jellies, you know, something which is like quite dense and light, but gives a sugar hit. And I think that will probably actually affect your ability to use glycogen, so that you're actually using glycogen in the week. And you look at, even back in, there's like reviews from like Ron Mann in the 90s, even showing how that diet isn't actually that effective at reducing muscle glycogen. And if you look at, even if you go look at Sam Impey's paper, you know, that fuel the work required. And if you look at the graph when they're looking at muscle glycogen, you know, when they're showing that glycogen threshold hypothesis, and, you know, long duration exercise kind of brings it down. But, you know, the short, high intensity exercise really drops muscle glycogen fast and low. Like the lowest muscle glycogen gets is like after high intensity exercise. So like if you have an athlete who has the ability to do a high intensity exercise session, you know, the day before his weigh in, that's probably going to be the most effective way to reduce muscle glycogen. Just don't put carbohydrate back into the system after. And that'd be my interpretation from just like just going through all the research from like I've gone through from like the 70s up to like 2010s at the moment. And I suppose like that's probably two ways I've kind of changed my perception on glycogen carbohydrate since the last time we spoke.
Yeah, and it's super fascinating, right? And that's just the way that science goes, is that you're constantly improving your practice. And without giving away too many industry secrets about like what we do, I've noticed this for a long time, because with all of our athletes, when we meal plan with them, we break all their intake into grams per kilogram of fat-free mass. And the carbohydrates are never really that high. Not in the sense when you're talking endurance sports, when you've got the, you know, 8 to 10 grams per kilogram is considered high, and 6 to 8 or whatever it is. We're never really hitting into, not even into that mild. Yet these guys are still seeming to get through this training session. They're still seeming to get through it, and they're still going. Mark, can you just elaborate on this one point? Because I think this is something I always get asked about. When these guys are attempting to, say, reduce this muscle glycogen, say in a fight week, we're taking out exogenous carbohydrates, so carbohydrates in the diet. You mentioned there how we store glycogen in the liver, and we also store it in the muscle. Now, if these guys, fasted cardio is something that so many people do, but with the interpretation that you wake up and that you'll be running without glycogen and you'll be using, you know, quote unquote fat burning more. Is it true that you just overnight you're using the liver glycogen and then you'll have that muscle glycogen stored? And is this feedback into what you were saying? It all depends where you start from with the muscle glycogen point, or what are your thoughts on that? Hey guys, I just quickly want to give a shout out to the team over at Macro Mike. Only because snacking is my favorite thing to do in this life, and Macro Mike has changed the game when it comes to healthy snacks. What they do is use clean and healthy plant-based ingredients, and they make healthy versions of all of those things that you thought you weren't supposed to eat. They make peanut butter and mixes for cookies, brownies, and donuts that you can whip up in literally minutes. And best of all, these are all completely clean and taste beyond phenomenal. They also make protein supplements, protein bars, plant-based aminos, and a great product for your gut health called the Gut Doctor. The flavors that these guys have are seriously insane. Some of my favorites are chocolate hazelnut, Hawaiian salted vanilla, and strawberry jam donut. For a self-confessed snacker, these are a lifesaver. They've been nice enough to give my listeners 10% with the code TFD10, so you guys can try them for yourself. Alrighty, back to the show.
Yeah, if you don't reduce muscle glycogen from a training session from the day before, you'll probably still have muscle glycogen in the muscle. So a lot of like the training studies, if you look at any of the research video with Liverpool John Moores, is that they'll do like a training session the night before and then not feed carbohydrate after, and then they'll commence the low muscle glycogen session in the morning. You know, so you have like a two training session effect. So the first training session is to deplete muscle glycogen, and then the second one is to actually quote unquote train low. So yeah, so they do use, and you can do that in practice though as well. So if you think about if an athlete is doing like a PM training session, you can just tell them, you know, if you cut out any carbohydrate from their last meal, that might have somewhat an effect of reducing muscle glycogen. But yeah, during the night, you're probably not going to be using up muscle glycogen that much. It's going to be liver glycogen. Now, I don't know how much of a, like, that might regulate exercise in itself, because I think liver glycogen is actually a pretty powerful regulator. Now, you know, I'd have to refer to anyone like looking to read more, be like Javier Gonzalez has a couple of review papers, but it's something that I kind of want to get into a little bit deeper. But I think liver glycogen might be a pretty important signaling, you know, like muscle glycogen signals like in the muscle. I think liver glycogen might be an important regulator of like exercise performance as well, because if you do have low liver glycogen, you know, your body is kind of like liver glycogen is what is basically feeding blood glucose all the time. You know, you're essentially maintaining blood glucose from the liver, and if that starts getting low, that might start signaling in some sort of like defense mechanism, or you know, you might actually get a decrease in performance. Even though muscle glycogen is fine, if you do get decreases in liver glycogen to a level where the body might think that, oh, you're going to have to start taking away from something else to maintain blood glucose, that could have an impact on performance. But I'm not an expert in liver glycogen, and I tell people to just read like Javier Gonzalez's work, because he pretty much is.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. And just going back to that point, Mark, are we saying, or is your school of thought now that it's not so much that your training, you or you need to be in a high glycogen or in a high carbohydrate feeding state to do this training? It's more the overall glycogen. So it depends on how you fed or what your training status was leading up to that. And so if fighters are doing these more lower carb diets, that's more the normal, and it doesn't seem to impact performance as much.
I'd say if you're doing chronic low carb, that does seem to impair adaptation, for the reason that if you're chronically low carb, you know, you're not going to be putting as much carbohydrate back in after each training session. So you will get decreases. You'll probably actually deplete muscle glycogen in some of the training sessions as some of these athletes do, because they are quite intense, especially if you're not starting from a high point. And then if you're not putting as much back in, you're never going to have like a very, very full muscle glycogen. But what happens in the longer term training studies with kind of like high fat, low carb diets is that you essentially get impaired training quality. So you've got lower muscle glycogen throughout the training camp. And as much as, you know, we as nutritionists like to, you know, talk about how much we can improve training performance with nutrition, if you can't get good training sessions in, you're not going to adapt to them as well. So that's like key point number one, is kind of like get a good quality training session in. And if you're low carb all the time, now I'm not saying you can't do some training sessions. In fact, you probably can't do some sessions, and it might come back to, you know, periodized carbohydrate intake and fueling for the work required. So yeah, you're changing carbohydrate depending on what you need. But if you're low carb all the time, you'll impair your ability to train long term. And then that will lead to impaired training adaptations, irrespective of what you're doing with the diet or any effect that the diet is having on metabolism. You're not going to be able to train for as long or as hard if you're just low all the time. So I'd say obviously a lot of the training sessions we planned out, and then you should plan the nutrition in accordance with that, so that you are fueling before a harder session to make sure that they can get the good quality sessions in, because that's what's going to simulate adaptation primarily.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to reiterate to the people listening, we're not saying that you should be going low carbohydrate and that this isn't a justification.
I'm more so saying that I don't think it's as detrimental as I once thought. But like equally, like there's pretty much no research that says it's a benefit, you know? There's no research that says it's a benefit. It's just, you know, I'm just kind of like looking. I'm probably just, it's probably more of an academic point, because the recommendation hasn't really changed that much. Like, you know, unless you're saying like carbohydrate cycle or periodized, but we're saying periodized anyway.
And I think it's a good point if we more put it back in a context of combat sport athletes, especially MMA athletes or boxers or Muay Thai, whatever, and they've got that 30-36 hour window where you use this glycogen reduction or glycogen depletion to the best of your ability leading up to that weigh-in where you are. So maybe it is not as detrimental as what we once thought to drop out carbohydrates for 5 days, given that you've got that time period to put that glycogen back in. Now, Mark, I want to get your thoughts, because we did have a very good discussion with Lewis about putting that carbohydrate back in. And this is a point that I think Lewis brought up that almost not caught us all off guard, but such a great point, right? Where he talks about, we're not actually doing the exercise to translocate those GLUT4s, whereas a lot of the glycogen resynthesis research comes back to this point where, you know, after endurance activity or someone's on the bike for 3 hours and then we measure how their glycogen gets put back in. What are your thoughts with that in terms of combat sport athletes who, say, for the 24 hours making weight weren't exercising, they were doing it passively and, say, sitting in a sauna or sitting in a bathtub? How's that going to affect the refeeding period where we're trying to restore this glycogen?
Yeah, well, I actually prefer my athletes to do active, well, not just active, but I do like them to do some form of act of kind of dehydration. And that would be one of the reasons why I started to get, are getting like an exercise stimulus that primes the muscle. So I don't know if I'm right in saying this, you know, like, cause like you said, there's a lot that we don't know. And we're kind of like last time, I could in a year's time say, oh no, I was wrong. They should be doing passive dehydration. But that'd be one reason why I personally, like, and again, this is just practical stuff, based on some science, but practically, I typically recommend that athletes do some active, some form of active. A lot of boxers like to run, so they do like a jog, even if it's like 45, 60 minute jog, it's still getting some form of exercise in. So that'd be one on that. But and another reason is that it's something else that I want to kind of dig into, and it's hard because there's only this one paper that I can see. But this idea of like active versus passive dehydration, and I can't remember the name of the author of the paper, but there's one paper anyway that looked at passive dehydration, active dehydration, then they use diuretics as well. So obviously like pharmaceuticals to dehydrate. And what they saw, if you look at like plasma volume, despite the same level of dehydration, you get a 10% decrease in plasma volume in passive dehydration, whereas you don't get any decrease in plasma volume with active dehydration. Now, again, I'm basing this off one study, so I'm not going to throw all my eggs in one basket, but it's something that I've took into consideration when I'm thinking about active versus passive, because, you know, if you get decreased plasma volume, you know, I think, you know, you've had guests on before talking about, you know, that can lead to hypotension, and then you get hypoperfusion of tissues and so on. And I don't know how long it takes to rehydrate some of these tissues, and like when they say, I don't know how they measure, you know, I know I've heard people, you know, saying, oh, it takes this amount of time to get it into these cells, but I really have no idea like how they measure it. We're actually trying to get into a hospital to use the MRI so that we can dehydrate them and put them in under an MRI so that we can see like what happens in the brain, like how long does it take to rehydrate? Can you rehydrate pretty quickly? I think like listening to Lewis, like you can rehydrate pretty quickly. But then you listen to some clinicians, and they're saying, oh, it takes a while to get back into the cell. But then I'm thinking, like, how are these studies performed? It sounds to me, now I could be wrong, it's like I'm saying, it sounds just from listening that they're like in vitro, so you're like cell type of studies where they're not actually measuring like in the person, because how else are they measuring that it's getting back into the cells, if that makes sense, unless they're taking some sort of biopsy maybe.
That's a great point. It's a great point that Oliver, who came on, who I would consider a hydration expert around, he says this exact same thing, right? It's like, we don't really know because there's no tool available at the moment to assess whether we, other than if you were to MRI and do it in a live athlete, just lean in the MRI machine, there's no assessment tool that we can use. And this was the discussion. And I think this is another good point, like another theoretical consideration to bring up, is that we can talk about all these hydration protocols and getting all this back in, but there's really no way for us as clinicians to know if they're hydrated. Yeah, we can do a USG, we can do a urine specific gravity. No one carries around, I don't carry a USG with me. I don't carry a needle to do a serum osmolarity test with them. Yes, you can use urine to assess it, but does the fluid in the urine represent whole body hydration? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And I think that's a good point. We have no idea how we would assess how well this hydration.
Yeah, and that kind of works both ways, because, you know, if we think we can hydrate pretty quickly, and we might, and then you have other side saying that it takes longer, but we've got no real way to answer. It's particularly when you're talking about, you know, well, some people will say these tests are coming up normal, but we don't know what's going on inside the cells. And then I'm just like, I don't know, how do you measure that? Like, what's going on inside the cells? I don't know. I think I'm looking at, there's a good paper by Chevron, I think it's 2014. It took me ages to read it, but it's a really, really in-depth paper on hydration, dehydration, like methods of assessment and stuff like that. But it's really in-depth. But I think he was talking about, you know, kind of like measuring intracellular fluid and extracellular fluid. And I think one of the ones which was in the middle that can measure both might be, what's the name of it? Bioimpedance, so spectroscopy or something like that. And again, I need to go through all this again, but that seems like it might be an okay tool, because we have one now which trying to get set up. And I know they have one now in Liverpool as well, where they use that quite often. And there's something that I might look into a little bit more to see, because like them tools are essentially more to measure body water, you know, they give you like a total body water. Some of them actually will give you a breakdown of compartment. I don't know how valid it is. I know the one that they have in Liverpool, that I think that gives you a breakdown of intracellular and extracellular fluid. But that's something I'll look into and see, like, how valid are they and can they be used? Because some of them they're very easy to use, some of them things, you know. Like we have one which is, it's a stand, like kind of like the one in Liverpool, but you can also kind of break it down and make it portable. So you can break off the top part of it and you can break off the feet part, and it can become, instead of having this big stationary thing, you can turn it into a mobile unit to measure potentially total body water.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if the guests aren't confused enough as it is in what we're saying and how much we don't actually know about it, I think let's finish off with this, Mark. And then it's like, okay, we talk about all of this and yes, we can theoretically deplete glycogen, we can water load, we can remove salt, we can reduce glycogen, we can put it back in, we can put the fluids back in with the electrolytes. And then it comes to the performance. And like you were saying, we have for this kind of gray area where you're talking earlier about, you know, the meaningful amount of carbohydrate and what does that do to performance? It's like, well, what about these strategies in terms of nutrition? How much of an effect do they have on the performance come fight night?
Yeah, so that's something that we're looking to implement now in studies. So once this COVID thing is over, we're doing another BAT study with John, higher salt concentration, and we're going to be implementing the UFC performance test after the study now. So we kind of think that after, if we're doing any kind of like weight cutting study, we should really try implement performance tests. And because with John's athletes, they're MMA fighters, we're going to do the UFC battery, you know, just because to see how it influences, you know, UFC grade markers of performance. And because there's not a lot, again, when you look at the research into, you know, weight cut, rehydrate, and then actually perform, you know, there's very little out there. So we're going to start looking into that and see actually how it does perform. But, you know, I think with the weight cut, it's hard to know because people do different percentages and people respond differently. People are going to be acclimatized to, if it's your first time cutting weight versus, you know, your 15th, 20th time cutting weight, you're probably going to be able to respond a little bit differently. But with regards to just like if you're talking more global performance, I think once muscle glycogen, I suppose this is just from a nutrition perspective. There's a whole lot of other things that go into, you know, how you feel and how you perform. But from a nutrition perspective, like once you are, you know, in a glycogen repleted state and a hydrated state, and you know, you could probably be like 1 or 2% off with in terms of hydration. Then you start getting maybe cognitive impairments. But anyway, yeah. So once muscle glycogen in terms of performance, it seems to be one of the key drivers, particularly if you're thinking about exercise capacity. So you probably won't be able to do a 5x5 if you're not going in a fully fueled state, or you will, but you'll look like the people and you look at them and you know, geez, they've had a big wake up. Sometimes you can tell. You can either, like, and this isn't reflected in the research actually either. Like, I don't know if you noticed this, but you ever look at like Yoel Romero gets in the ring and after two rounds he's blown. Like he's gassed. He like halfway through the second round, he is gassed, and I'm sure he's not an unfit guy, but he cuts a lot of weight. And you know, the studies that we do, you know, none of it kind of reflects like how do big weight cuts influence exercise capacity? You know, how probably won't get ethics to do it. You know, you won't get an ethics to do a Yoel Romero cut, but you see them, some of these guys, you can just visually, you know, I don't know if you notice, but sometimes you look at them in the middle of the fight and you can just tell, you know, they must have had a big weight cut. And then you intuitively think that, but yeah, it's not reflected in the literature. You know, there's that, like even the Paddy the Baddy case study, like he gassed out at the start of the week, not even at the end of the weight cut. So what would the effects if he was to then do what would be the performance effects after the weight cut in that study?
Yeah, it's super interesting. What do you think? I think let's finish on this, Mark. What do you think is the way forward? Obviously, you're very heavily involved in the research. Combat sports is growing at such a rapid rate. And I guess it is. It's so great that we have so much researchers. We have practitioners that are putting eyes on this. But I feel like more than any other sport, this area, especially what we just spoke about, that water cut and then how that translates to performance, is almost still an area that we shy away from. And it's something that I personally feel is if we're going to make the sport better and make it safer as a whole, we kind of need to come together and we need to figure out a way, how do we assess this so we can make better recommendations and say, hey, look, absolutely do not do that. And absolutely don't, that's my bad. But yeah, don't do that. What do you think is the best way to go about that from a research perspective?
Yeah, I suppose whatever we have to do in research, we have to try get it, one, reflective of what's happening in practice, two, show that it's better for performance, because you have it, it's like most sports, if you can show that they'll perform better. Like if you can show an athlete, you know, you'll perform better or you'll win more at a higher way, you probably won't be able to show that they'll win more really. But if you can show that they can perform better, that's what, you know, you need to start bringing it back to performance. Like, like these athletes are cutting weight, they don't really care about health that much. Particularly if you've got like a $60,000 fight, or I think I said this last time, like I'd probably be willing to push the body a little bit further if I knew I was going to get 60,000 at the end of it, you know. So you have to draw back to performance. And I think a lot of focus will be on this kind of last week phase, because it's the only phase that's really different to other sports. Because prior to that last week, you know, all you're doing is you're dieting down, reducing body fat. And, you know, you do that in various other sports. Bodybuilding is a good, very good example, and models it off. You know, you're basically just reducing body fat and maintaining lean mass. And we have pretty good, like, general research. I don't think there's a lot of research that needs to be done on how to lose body fat. You know, it's the last week is where all the kind of risks are, and that's where, you know, the big weight cuts are. Up to then, you know, you're cutting, you know, whatever, 0.5 to 1% body weight, just kind of like bog standards. I know you're like, you're dealing sport nutrition in the middle, but again, it's like other sports. If you're cutting weight in other sport, or reducing body mass in other sports, you're doing stuff with nutrition. It's that last fight week is what really differentiates combat sports. And I think that's where more of the research is going to go now, because we've had like case studies, a good few case studies now I know come out. So I think we're probably going to be shifting to these kind of like, what strategies can we use to either one, make it safer, or two, make it easier? Because I think that's a big thing as well. You know, how easy can you cut the weight? You know, I think that's what gets a lot of buy-in from the athletes. Probably why like Lockhart gets a lot of buy-in is that, you know, he waterload them and he give all these things to try and make the water come off easier, regardless of like if it helps performance or if it helps health. You know, he's making the cook, quote unquote, easier for them. So I think that will probably get buy-in from athletes. Like, that the good thing about Oliver Barley's study is that, you know, heat acclimation turned it from 3 hours in the sauna to 2 hours in the sauna. And that's a big win. You know, you tell an athlete, you know, well, do this, and instead of having to cut for 3 hours in the sauna, you cut for 2 hours in the sauna, and a lot of them will bite your hand off, you know. So if you, that type of stuff, you know, you're making meaningful impact on what's going to make the cut easier. And then if you can then start relating that to performance as well. So yeah, this cut's going to be easier, and actually, you know, you're going to perform better at the end of it. So you do these things, or if you, you know, do your nutrition this way, you know, you're going to be in a glycogen depleted state for less of a time instead of the whole camp. And you're going to, if you do, for example, in a run in the morning of the wake up, you know, to get the last pound or two off, you're going to refuel better, and that's going to then impact performance again. So, but we need the science to actually demonstrate that as well, you know, so we can make a nice graph or something like that and say, look, performance up, small bar, big bar.
Yeah, that's it. So we can throw it up on MJ Nutrition and show them the hard science. That's a good point to finish on, Mark. I think that's great. And I think that really summarizes it, is that we know so much, yet we know so little. And that's basically science, isn't it? And like you said, science is a constantly evolving field. And I think one of the silver linings of this episode, where we've talked about all the things we don't know, is that that's probably a good thing. It means that the science is moving in the right direction. We're getting a lot of research on there. We're having conversations like this and putting it out to all the people listening, and hopefully they take it on board and they start thinking about it like that. Mark, I know we went through this last time, but if people want to get onto you, they want to see these graphs on your Instagram, they want to email you, they want to ask you some questions yourself, they want to work with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, like I said earlier on, so my email, probably easiest to contact, would just markjermaine91@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter, like complaining a lot on Twitter. I probably rant more on Twitter, just at Mark Germain. And then my Instagram is mgermain91. And I throw up the odd infograph on a different page just so it doesn't clutter my own page. I think that's MG Nutrition or something like that. It's just I just made up the handle. Just so what it was is that all the infographs were just cluttering up my own private Instagram. So I just made another page that I can just throw them on there. I think that's MG Nutrition 101 or something like that. Yeah, it's not like a brand or anything. It's just a page that I throw infographs on.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, mate. Well, there we go. Full circle. Hey, first episode and then back on for whatever number episode this is. But I appreciate you coming on, mate. And I'll get you on for the three-peat. We'll come on the third time, maybe in 1 year's time. And everything we just spoke about then will probably be completely wrong on as well, which would, you know, wouldn't be a bad thing.
Probably go full 360. I've gone 180. To some stuff now. I'll go 180 back to the start.
Yeah, hey, welcome to the world of science. All right, mate, well, I'll catch up with you soon. Hey, thanks for coming on.
No worries, chat on.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. What a great episode that highlights the core nature of science. Practitioners like Mark are needed in this field because this evidence is constantly changing, and as it changes, we as practitioners need to adjust our approaches to help ensure our athletes are staying safe and getting the most out of their training. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.